Hello, my name is Jack, and you're listening to Working in TV. Hello, everyone. How are you all doing? Hope you've had a good week. So we're back with another episode. This week's guest is Lydia Curry. She is a first assistant director. Not going to go too much into what we talk about because it's quite a long show, so I just want to get on with it. But just to say, I'll be back at the end. And yeah, I really hope you enjoy this one because I know we enjoyed recording it. So this is me talking to Lydia Curry about working in TV. My guest today has worked on 24, Black Mirror, Friday Night Dinner, Ashes to Ashes, and Hustle, just to name a few. She is the first assistant director, and her name is Lydia Curry. How are you, Lydia?
I'm very well, Jack. Lovely to see you.
How's life going post-lockdown, mid-lockdown, whatever we are now?
Yeah, good. My industry is finally starting to rise, Phoenix-esque, from the ashes of COVID. But with just so many changes that it'll be interesting to see how many of them we adopt as practice going forward into the brave new industry it's going to create. But it is very different. It's quite a, obviously from an AD's perspective, the additional logistics that the COVID safety has to add onto everything we do is vast. And a bit unknown and a bit sketchy as the advice changes every 10 minutes, as we know. So it's very difficult to kind of say to your cast and crew, it's okay, we got this, when you're not sure our government has got this, let alone anybody else, you know.
Yeah, so exactly.
That adds another frisson to the work, shall we say.
Oh, yeah, to an already difficult job logistically. So let's start off with the same question I like to ask everyone. Mm-hmm. What is a first assistant director and what do they do?
So a first assistant director basically takes the script that you are working on, breaks it down into its constituent parts, and creates a schedule which the shooting crew then follow to complete filming. So in prep, we'll work with the director to really mine into the detail of what they want out of this script. So, you know, how many background artists, what particular props is there? Must this scene be sunny, or have we got rain bar, or have we got all the different detail that creates what you see on the screen? We kind of put together onto our schedule. We talk to every department to make sure what we are putting down is realistic for them to achieve. You know, can they get certain sets ready by then? Are costumes available? Are actors available? And then we present it to the unit in the production meeting, and we say, this is what we are going to do. This is what we are aiming to achieve. And then day by day, we run the set. So we have to then make sure we do what we said we could do. So we're sort of like teacher, and you stop talking, you hurry up. Where's that thing? Come on. So we're sort of the hustlers. I like to say it's with the director's mouthpiece, because often I get mistaken for the director to the untrained eye, because I'm the one you see the most, I'm the one you hear the most.
Yeah.
And they all go, oh, you're directing. I'm like, absolutely not. The director sat in a chair, not moving, just telling me to go and do his bidding, actually, or her bidding. So it's when it's great, it's wonderful and it's fun and there's nothing like it. And when it's bad, it's pretty terrible. But, you know, I think most things can fall into those categories, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. I've witnessed starting out as a runner and then doing third AD. I witnessed the highs and the lows.
Yes,
definitely. But it's interesting that you said about sometimes people think that you're the director, because that's something that comes up on this podcast quite a lot, is how people even in the industry, but people outside the industry especially, they don't really know the jobs and they don't.
No, exactly.
So if they saw you, they would see that, oh, you're in charge, so you're the director.
Yeah.
But they don't really realize that there's all these very nuanced, very specific jobs that exist. Because obviously before I started, as a kid or something, cameraman, director, actor, sound maybe if you it's a guy with a boom. But people don't really know the specific jobs. And maybe that's what this podcast is really about, is trying to sort of showcase all those different jobs so people can see that there are different things they can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's questions that always come through. The three most common are, what does a producer actually do? What's the grip? And what's the best boy? And, you know, why would you know what those things are? I still don't know what a producer does, some of them, but, you know.
There's so many different types, though. That's what confuses me. And on every job to job, their remit seems to be very different. And it's almost like personal, like this person is this kind of style of this kind of job.
Exactly.
I'd love to get a couple of producers on here just to get them to tell me what the heck they do.
Well, you'd never get a straight answer either. I think that's the beauty of that role. It's all kind of veils and mirrors, but
The politicians of TV and film.
But honestly, like I'm working with a very experienced executive producer at the moment, who has been around for decades and knows the industry backwards. And the more I see of his work, the more I'm going, how are you still alive? How has the stress not killed you of all these particular egos and personalities, basically using you as their kicking boy? It's tough at the top, and I'm not.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
that's good.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny you saying that, because like that's kind of the impression I have, not of you, but like specifically, but of your role. I see that role as, and I very nearly went in that direction, like I said before. But I see that role as, how have you not been killed by the sheer stress and effort and time?
Yeah, I think you have to have a. There's an expression I use all the time, which I think sums it up beautifully. It's not your fault, but it is your problem. So invariably, the one thing that happens, so basically I'm queen of time. The thing that I care about most is time, because I'm trying to protect the director's time from being spent on things that you don't see on screen. So, you know, for example, if the grips need an hour to build the crane and the track, you need to know that in advance so they can do it before we start. And then they're on a pre-call and the director turns up and it's ready and they can just shoot. But invariably what happens when mistakes happen, and, you know, we work very long hours and people change their minds and all of those elements that go naturally with filming, means that the one thing that all of those things have in common is that they use up more time than they were meant to. So as I said, it's not my fault, but it is my problem. Where you've spent 2 hours on something you weren't meant to, where do you get that time back from? Where's the pocket that you've kind of tucked down the back of the radiator of the schedule that you knew this was going to happen, really? Because you get over time, you do learn that, you know, producers often try and talk directors out of things in recces because they can't afford it, or you know, that there is something wrong with what the director really wants in their heart. And every time I'm there going, but that's what we're going to end up doing. So why we should just cut all this and just go, okay, he's, you know, this person's going to get talked out of this now, but I know full well when we get there on the day, he's going to, you know, he or she's going to go, actually, I really want that. And I'm not going to do everything I said I was going to do. I'm going to do what I want. And so actually it is much quicker in the long run to just really listen to what the director wants, because you ultimately you're going to do that anyway. But that takes practice and patience. You have to let those conversations kind of wind themselves out, rather than, because the minute you force them, you'll get the wrong answer, frankly.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I suppose it's about knowing that that will happen, so being prepared for it, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Because in that scenario you were saying there, the producer's mind, they've talked them out of it, so it isn't going to happen.
Exactly.
So there needs to be no planning for that.
Precisely.
But in your head, you're going, an experienced person goes, okay, so this probably will happen. Mm. So how do we figure that out ahead of time? So then when they go, oh yeah, I want to do it this way because I'm the director and I'm in charge.
Yeah.
Then you go, okay, we have an idea, or we've built air into the schedule somewhere that we can squeeze out.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I think an AD said that to me once. He builds air pockets into things and he can squeeze a day. So he'll know that a day that's scheduled to go in the park, he knows that that's only really going to take 3 hours, but he's got a whole day there. So he's like, I can sort of maneuver around that.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, there's several versions of this saying, but it's Ben-Hur in the morning, Benny Hill in the afternoon. It's always the same. It doesn't matter how much money you've got or how experienced the crew, it does not matter. If you don't get a decent, I think the scheduling of the top of the day is very important because it sets the pace and the tone for the rest of the day. If you have a bad start, you're always chasing your tail. You never catch up and it's terrible. But if you can just get the momentum started quickly, you find that I don't need to really push very much at all and it just sort of flows. But often you don't have that choice. You know, there is often a big scene that you're like, well, I can't do that after lunch. Everyone's asleep. You know, we need to start the day with that, and that's going to take time. And therefore, the momentum of the day just never really kicks in. And at 4 o'clock, you're going,
Still 3 hours plus.
Exactly.
That's interesting that you say that about like the type of scenes that, what time of day that you try and film them. That's because I've kind of always known that in my mind, subconsciously, I've known that certain scenes are harder to do after lunch or first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
But I've never really thought about it consciously that would be part of your thinking when you're scheduling.
Yeah. I think it also depends where you grew up, for want of a better expression. So, you know, I was very lucky that when I was a young first, BBC Four was just emerging. So
yeah.
Obviously, everybody can tell that BBC Four does wonderful projects, but they've got no money at all. So actually, I had to schedule in a way that saved them money. So, for example, stuntmen are expensive. Surprise, surprise. You need to make sure you finished. You are definitely going to finish with that stunt player that day, because if you don't, you're doubling the cost on that person if they have to come back the next day, that type of thing. So my kind of proper training and scheduling was very much with the idea that the schedule can save the production a lot of money if done well, and spend just as much if done badly. So that's particular to me, because I consider myself very lucky to have had that grounding, because it means you can always scale it up. If a production got a lot of money and they don't care, great, then you don't need to apply any of that and nobody cares. However, most productions in their way do care. So
I was going to say, where are these productions that don't care about time and money? I'd like to get on that.
Exactly. I mean, but like, you know, the big bastards that can buy out Anthony Hopkins for 6 months really care about a stunt player doing a day or two extra. But you know, the little shows that don't have that luxury and are often, frankly, better scripts, they do care about stuff like that.
I agree. I've witnessed that when I suppose I started out in a similar way in kids TV, that it's the budgets were very small, the scripts were really fun and interesting and trying to do new things, but I felt like I learned, it's helped me in my prop career because I learned to do things as a third AD. I learned to do things and have multiple things happening at once. And I knew the order of things, and I knew that we couldn't afford to not get everything. Do you know what I mean? So we had to be very clever and very strict, and it got my mind into a place where it's never really left that things need to happen in an order. And if I take too long doing my thing, then it messes it up for everyone else. And I feel like, not to put anyone down who hasn't started in lower budget stuff, but this seems to be coming up again and again when I talk to people on this show, is that people who started in entertainment or in kids TV or in low budget documentaries, they tend to be more drilled and a little bit more aware of the fact that you don't always have as much time as you think or you need. Yeah. So be ahead of the game kind of thing. And I suppose I don't really have hundreds of examples of people that aren't like that, but it just seems to me a very common attribute to anyone who has started out in any of the...
I mean, I do. We're interviewing, I'm back on Avenue 5 Series 2 at the moment, and we're interviewing the rest of the ADs. And it has come up a few times where the level of budget that Avenue 5's at attracts people from across the spectrum. And looking at, you know, we've interviewed somebody who's Star Wars born and raised, and we didn't give him the job because in the end we were like, no, you expect 40 people in your team. We don't have that, and we don't want that.
Yeah,
that's not the ethos of this show. You know, and you know, we use the word grand with the big films, and it's unfair on them really, because they don't know any different. You know, they've got a team of 100. That's normal. That's all they've ever known. Why would you ever do it with just two? You know, so. But I mean, I really consider myself very lucky to be able to do both. Because yeah. I don't think you can go the other way once you've had 40 people do get your cups of tea for you, you know.
Yeah, it's I think it's very difficult to work harder than you've been working.
Yes.
Like if you graduate to use a bad word, like into films or into giant TV, like perhaps 24 maybe for you, like when you see that there's all that money and there's all that time and there's all those people, you can, you're kind of a smaller cog, therefore you're like there's less pressure on you. But yeah, stepping backward, you know, to use another term that I don't necessarily agree with, into lower budget stuff, you realize, oh my god, I've got to do loads of stuff, and it's like that must be a very hard step to go the other way.
24 was a really good example because everybody on the series when I joined it was film. All of them are kind of this, you know, the Spielbergs and the Star Wars and all the rest of it. But 24 is television. And the thing that's peculiar to television that film genuinely doesn't know how to deal with is that television doesn't have scripts ready. And 24 in particular are particularly bad at having stuff available. So, for example, I did 4 episodes of 24 and I did the finale. Some executive in the States had made the very interesting decision to start airing the series while we were still making it. Now, bear in mind, bear in mind this is an action show with a star that's 50. You know, it's like that was brave, if you want to use that word anyway. But then they aired 4 episodes before I started episode 7. So by the time we got to the end, you know, the last 2, 11 and 12, the only thing that anybody cared about was the episode number because it was literally on air. So I think we wrapped episode 12 and episode 12 aired in the States 10 days later. It was the worst turnaround I've ever seen. But we didn't have the scripts for 11 and 12 when I started prepping them 12 days before we shot them. Now to the film crew.
Yeah.
Their head blew off. They were like, well, we can't, you know, they were like, this is impossible. How can you possibly be so calm? We haven't got a script. I'm like, I know, we never have a script. You know, so actually it fell to my advantage. They couldn't comprehend how you could even start prepping anything without what's on the page. It's like, but no, we know certain things. We know Stephen Fry is the Prime Minister. We know he will only work at this location because that's where we've always seen him.
Yeah.
We have to check when Stephen's available and when that location is available, and we just have to book them. And you it's amazing how much you can do without the words. And also, when the words are so late, as an AD, you have a far greater influence on how the final product runs, because you're basically saying, well, I can't give you that. You will have to put that scene in this space, because that's the only space I've got available in the schedule. So it actually allows ADs, you know, we're a non-creative role largely, but allows you far more input into the final piece when it's that mental. Whereas film, to get the money at all, has to have a lot of script, because the investors are basically saying, I'm putting my money into these words on this page, and the minute you change that, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm paying you to make
this
that script
right here and not a word different. So it's been there for 8 months and it's one, and everybody knows one story very, very well. So of course they're practically an inch of their life, and they've done 6 months of costume fittings and the rest of it, because they've had the work in front of them for so long. So
the continuity of it all manages to become a lot easier because you're not jumping. You're not at this location jumping. Okay, so now this is 6 months later because this is episode 4, but then episode 2 will go back. So we need to take the scar off his face, and then we need to have him in this costume. Yeah. So I agree that film, it must be such a luxury. It's such a nice thing to have a text.
Exactly. But that's all that the film world knows. Unless you do the big Tom Cruise things where he and Russell Crowe, and they come in and they rewrite it every day. But then they know that's what those particular stars do. So then they go, that's fine. But that was, so 24 was really interesting because weirdly, I was the only one that was sort of calm in that. They were just kind of going, we have no idea how you're doing this. And it's like, this is normal. And I'm like, you know, and...
I mean, that must two things really. That must be really good for you in your like in your mind as your satisfaction, because you must be able to go, oh, I can show people that I can do this and I can nail it and get it all great. And also that must be great for your reputation because they've gone, how the hell are you doing this? And you're like, well, because this is what I do. Yes. So they must think, oh, wow, she's like incredible. But it's you know, I'm sure you are, but it's like, it's because that's the training you've had and you've had to do that. So
yes, however, so I did 24 in 2014. So 6 years later, for example, I've just bumped into my third on 24, who's a very talented man. But, you know, he's first in the second unit of Batman. So do you see what I mean? Those worlds, we don't mix. The film is the last, I want to say the last bastion of snobbery. I don't really mean it like that, because that suggests they're not lovely people, and most of them absolutely are. But they do not trust, they still don't trust telly, and they never have, you know. And so even though, you know, some of the best scripts in the world are coming through television at the moment, because just the platform and the money that's being put through the new kind of streaming services mean that television can compete with film, and we're not allowed to go to the cinema at the moment. So, you know, kind of independent cinema really has vanished, sadly, I think. The industry hasn't quite caught up yet, if you see what I mean.
Why do you think, and I've spoken to a lot of people about this on this show particularly as well, why do you think, I think I've got a reason why, but why do you think that it is film crew and it is TV crew? Because essentially, other than what you've said about script and time and budget, it's essentially filming people talking to each other and people doing things. It's the same job, but why is it that there's film crew and then there's TV?
I think it's genuinely about scale. I think, you know, television does not historically have the money that some of it has now, not all of it. But like, you know, and film, if you look at some of the set pieces in the Marvel films, or even like some of the war films that have been created over the last 20 years, they're massive. You know, the Gandhi call sheet has 2,000 extras on it. No AD in television is going to say, oh yeah, I've done that. You know, so I think it's genuinely about scale, that film know that the people that are trained in film know how to do big, 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 and they're not faced by incredibly famous people. And, you know, so I think that's probably the root of it, really. I genuinely think that's what it is. That they, and also the film is, well, most of them is bonded. So you have to go and sit in front of a bond company that are guaranteeing the money back to the investors, basically. And they are going to look at your CV and go, can you do this or not? And you'd be amazed how often they go and you can't. It's like, why? I've been a first for, you know, 18 years now. And I have been bonded. I'm fine. But there was definitely a point, you know, 10 years ago where they were like, nah, we've never heard of you. I said, well, that's not my problem, actually. That's, you know, nothing I can do about that. You know? But
I suppose. I mean, but the good thing looking at that is that, for me, I think TV is the more interesting place to be, because you have so much you can work on. So you can work on like a 6-part Channel 4 comedy, which you've done.
Yep.
And then you can go and work on, you know, Avenue 5, something which is like, which has more, like, I imagine the set of that probably does feel like the smaller shows, but like, as in like the crew, but there may be like just the scale of it and the story that you're telling, and because it's quite a specific, it's, you know, sci-fi, you don't really do that in TV unless you're doing, you know, Star Trek or something, which is very old school, kind of like a soap opera in a spaceship, really. So do you find within TV that the shows are very different?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So Avenue 5 is a really good example, because Simon Bowles is the designer on Avenue 5, who is an award-winning film designer. You know, there's nothing small about Avenue 5. We're using two of the biggest stages in Europe for our show, you know, for what is effectively a comedy. So it's got a bit of a kind of can't get pigeonholed very easily, Avenue 5. And, you know, Hugh Laurie's the lead, and you go, well, Hugh Laurie did Blackadder, but he's also House, and, you know, that kind of...
Yeah.
Oh. So it's actually really difficult to define it. But something like Friday Night Dinner, for example, which is all in one house with those four or five lovely people every day, and we don't go out very often, that's a totally different kettle of fish to anything which builds sets that spin on. I mean, Simon, our designer, has been on Avenue 5 for 4 years already. You know what I mean?
Wow.
It's absolutely vast. So, but I tend to find it's the American shows are the ones where the UK film crew go to, but British television, the things that come out, Channel 4 and the BBC and the kind of independent UK houses, they tend to be the much lower budget and the ones that struggle to get it done nicely, I want to say. They're the ones that are doing 11-day fortnights and 12-hour days, and, you know, they haven't got the right number of background, and, you know, all of those things that we can see as crew, and hopefully you don't notice on screen if the script and the performances are good enough, you know.
Well, that's it. I think a lot of those shows, like Friday Night Dinner and stuff, they are funny, very funny, and then that's what they're for.
Exactly.
So it almost feels like, obviously, Avenue 5 is really funny as well, but it's like you think, hold on, like comedy, and you're trying to do big spectacle as well, but it's like, okay, yeah, I can see why people struggle to pigeonhole that show, because it's trying to do everything, I suppose. But I think I really like that show. I think it works really well. But then when you look at like little comedies like that, you think, oh, okay, yeah, cool, like you don't need all this other stuff.
Yeah.
So that's why Avenue 5 feels like a very different show. So let's go back a little bit and let's talk about how you got into TV in the first place.
So I'm afraid it is a bit of nepotism, but it's also a bit of grit. So I basically went in to clean a tape cupboard at London Weekend for a week when I was 17. My dad worked for London Weekend and he did get me in the door, but I literally cleaned a tape cupboard. And then 2 years later I left and I went to the BBC, but it was, you know, I did a week in there, then I did a week on Blind Date, and I Blind Date with Scylla, that's how old I am, used to have they call it the desperate box, and basically what happened was that a lot of people would write in to the contestants they'd seen on the show and basically write them an introduction as, I'd love to go out with you type thing. And they would ask us to forward it on to the contestants. And basically, obviously, they never did. And we had to send the letter back to them with a cover letter saying,
oh dear,
terribly sorry, can't do that, but thank you for your interest in the show type thing. And I literally spent 2 weeks returning the desperate box. And then I went to Gladiators and, you know, held...
Oh, wow.
Held some contenders' handkerchief when they were crying when they lost, that type of shit, you know. So,
so the real glamorous end,
but the glamorous end of light entertainment, and light entertainment is a wonderful thing. But from an AD's perspective, it's not particularly challenging once you've opened the doors for said hosts to walk through. Then that sort of you done really. But I mean, and I did Friday Night Armistice, believe it or not. So I did work with Arm and David and Peter. A million years ago, so we did the Millennium Special. That's how long ago that was. You know, when I walked onto Avenue 5 last year, and David is back and Peter's back, and they're all still together. You know, they're still buddies working together. It's lovely to see. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, he's a good example of people taking people with them. Kind of, you know, like I think a lot of people, like his writers and a lot of his crew, I know a few people that have done some of his stuff and gone from one to the other. But do you have anyone in, like, who you take with you, or who've taken you in the past?
Definitely them? So when I was a third, I kind of I had a wonderful first called Mick Pantaleo, and he and I, you know, there was a point where we saw we'd worked with a prop man on a job a few years back, and he saw Mick on a film. We were filming on South Bank, and he and his partner walked past us. And he said, oh, look, there's Mick. So where's Lydia? So that was quite sweet, because it just meant that they kind of knew they were together. So Mick was very kind to me when I was a third. And my one of my lovely seconds, I've kind of had kind of three or four But like, yeah. Jenny was my runner when I was a third, and we've literally gone up. And Jenny did the last series of Avenue 5 as our second, and she's producing now. So, you know, so you do try and keep people if they kind of work with you as much as you can. But obviously, at some point, they've got to go on and do their own thing. So, bye.
Yeah. I suppose that's the thing as well with AD department, because of the sort of the structure of it and the different jobs. There's the entry level, and then there's like the you know, the top. It's interesting because I've talked to a lot of camera people about this, and camera department feels, from the outside, it feels quite a hierarchical department, like with DP and camera trainee. And but then I've talked to some of them, and they say that a lot of camera people don't look at it that way. They look at it as there's very specific jobs. And yeah, there's like progression if you want to, but there's also very specific skills to be a focus puller, to be a loader, that a DP might not be able to do. So do you find in the AD department, first of all, maybe we should define the roles, and then do you find that people graduate through them, or do people like one, stay with one, or go completely in a different direction?
So first of all, just to kind of go through them all, so there's the first AD at the top, who you know, does the schedule and then runs the set. The second AD is at base primarily, so the second AD produces the call sheets. They're the primary contact for costume, makeup, and all the cast, and they get them ready. They put them through costume and makeup in the morning, and they send them up to set for when we've decided we want them. Third AD is sort of the right-hand person of the first on set, and they also set the supporting artists. They make the background action look good. Third is a great job, I think. There's the runner. So they'll have a base runner to help the second, hopefully, and then kind of key floor runner and other floor runners. And then you'll have like cast runners and knock-off marshals and all that kind of stuff. But I think most firsts would agree that the best firsts have done every grade, because you then have a proper understanding of what the rest of your department is going through. When you ask for something ridiculous at the last moment, you have at least an understanding of what you've asked them to do when you've done it yourself. But having said that, I mean, I was a dreadful second, awful. It's not my personality at all. I find that the seconds, for me anyway, I think, particularly as I was the first at 25, and at the time in the genre I was in that kind of teledrama, there was about three women, there was about three of us. And so I found I had to wear quite a mask to get through the day and just kind of put up with the kind of that kind of low level, not abuse, that's too strong, but that kind of rubbish that you get off crew anyway was sort of amplified by the old git DPs that have all retired, thankfully. You know, the kind of, you can imagine.
I do.
What I got. So I found what I hated about seconding was the fact that if your phone rang at 4 o'clock in the morning, it was an actor in jail, and you were their one phone call. You had to pick up the phone.
Wow.
And I found I like the structure of firsting, where I work very hard and I'm kind of taking people through their working life. But when I call rap, that personality disappears. I can put it down. The crew kind of go, great, we're going home now. And it doesn't really bleed into the rest of my life. Whereas as a second, I think it does.
Yeah.
And you have to enjoy that. And I didn't, if you like. So I think, you know, there are very many wonderful career seconds who don't want to be the hated one on set that's shouting at everybody, you know. I think personality-wise, you can decide not to do that. And you know, if I was on bigger stuff, I loved thirding is the only creative part of the AD ladder, where you get set background and you get to have some creative input to what the frame looks like. I don't think she does it anymore, but only because I think she's decided to stay at home and be a mother for a while. But there was a wonderful third called Carly, who worked with Lee Grummet all the time. And she just stayed as his third because he went on and did great big stuff. And, you know, she was like, great, I get to do what I love on a bigger scale. I don't need to do anything else, you know. So it's personal choice and sort of with personality, if you like. But
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's interesting that you talked about seconding there, because I think that for me, from the outside, that seems like the most specific job. Like, I can see why you didn't get on with it, because it's, I think you're right. I think it's, if you, I think you either love that or you do it to get to the next place. And I can see why a good second is a really good, like a good thing to have, because it's that's tough. It doesn't feel like something I would have done if I'd stayed in the AD department. I don't think I would have done first thing either, because I don't think I would have been able to handle it.
Oh yeah, you'd be amazed. Because again, a lot of people say that, they kind of go, well, you know, how do you schedule? And it's like, well, most of it's done for you. Because there are two things which the schedule is driven by. One is the availability of the locations, and one is the availability of the cast. And actually, when those lock in, you've got very little choice you do to a point, obviously, but there are certain fixed things. The tide, for example, that's pretty locked, as is sunrise and sunset. Nothing you can do about that either. So, you know,
to the chagrin of many a director.
Exactly. And that was another one of the things when 24 came over, you know, they're all from LA, where the day is pretty flat.
Oh, yeah. Weather.
So we're going tonight now. And I'm like, John, it's June. Well, don't do that.
Yeah.
And you'll have like 4 hours of darkness. And they're like, bollocks. Sun's coming up 3 o'clock in the morning. I was like, shit. Quick, hurry up. Go. And I was like, well, we did try and tell you that the UK higher up the globe than you. We have short nights.
It doesn't have a perimeter of mountains either that kind of shield it from the sun.
Precisely. Yeah. So yeah, that was a bit of a shock to them. Bless them. They're like, yeah, don't do that.
That's funny.
So, yeah, exactly.
So moving it in a slightly different direction, were you working when lockdown came in?
Yes, I was in the middle of a show called Pennyworth. I was doing block two of Pennyworth. And we were halfway through our block. And there were percolating rumours, obviously, of what was coming. I was actually ill that week, so I was off anyway. And I said to my bosses on the Friday, I can come in, I'm better. Woke up at 2 o'clock that morning coughing, and I was like, I can't risk this being something that is, you know, more than a cold and get on the tube. So I didn't go in. And then I got a phone call like 4 o'clock that afternoon from my line producer going, don't worry, we won't be coming back tomorrow on Monday anyway. And then 5 months later, we restarted shooting, I want to say the 20th of August. So we went from the 13th of March to the 20th of August down. So, yeah, that was, and it was a very different beast when we went back. It was, it was well done. You know, I was very lucky to be on a show which has enough money to put into COVID practice, whereas some shows don't. Yeah. And I don't think morally or legally they should be working, but they are.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky enough to be on shows that have got enough money to do it properly. And I do know that crew are making choices based on that too. A lot of people coming back to Avenue 5 saying, well, no, we trust you. You will look after us better. Which is quite nice to know, but it shouldn't be that way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, you're right. It shouldn't be, and you shouldn't have to... The problem I find now is that people are having to choose between being very poor or their health, basically. Yeah. Yeah. Because I know, and you know, that we've all been on film sets where things happen that aren't necessarily the safest thing. Exactly. And there's jobs that prioritize getting it done rather than getting it done safely, you know. So for me, it just feels very scary that... And also, like, the nature of film crew and the kind of people that you work with that you don't necessarily know that well, and their lifestyles and their habits and what they're up to in the evenings. And, you know.
Exactly.
So for me, it just feels like at the moment why I'm not working is mainly that, really. Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, I've been offered a couple of things, but, it's like living up in the north of England as well adds a whole another issue of accommodation safety in that and all that kind of stuff. But how have you found working again in the new conditions? I mean, we touched on it a little bit earlier, but maybe we can go into that a bit more.
I think I think film crew is very peculiar because a film crew is like a little town in terms of it's got a lot of different personalities that do very different jobs that therefore have very different attitudes, I find, to COVID pandemic at all. So there's certain departments that are much more laissez-faire than others. But of course, you know, particularly with mask wearing and stuff, there's been some lapses. But actually, two things happened. Firstly, Leavesden, I'm based at Leavesden at the moment, and Leavesden, you have to wear a mask to be on site at Leavesden anyway. So they've sort of done half of it for us, because if they find you not wearing it, you get kicked out, and that's that. They don't let you back in.
That's good. It kind of takes it out of your hands, as it were.
It does, and it just creates a practice on site, which everybody has to adhere to, and it has to be at least that level. But... there's two things I've really found that we will struggle with for a while, and it's a cultural thing, the culture of not wanting to let your director down, saying no. Those things are very, very difficult to override in crew's heads. Yeah, I was just saying that the kind of the standing, so firstly, the standing by culture that we all kind of hover and in our line to be called in, that's all had to change. And that's, again, it's very difficult for crew to get through their heads because, you know, they've been trained in doing that for however long. And also just the whole kind of saying no. So I was saying that we'd had a costume problem where our showrunner on Pennyworth had asked costume for some really bright backgrounds, and they came out and they looked absolutely beautiful. But that was back in the day when we could have 100. And obviously now we've got 20, and they've got... and so, you know, this woman in this beautiful pink outfit, and I'm like, well, I can use her once. I need to change her to put her in something that I'm not going to notice that, like, she was over there. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. Because you have to pretend that there are other people to scatter them around. But yeah, because if they're too specific, they stand out, and you're like, how are they got there? And they were there yesterday, yeah.
And so, you know, so I've kind of said to Gautam, well, look, now I've only got 20 people that I need to reuse this person, and they're dressed too beautifully, they stand out too much. You've got to help me chain. Can you, if you've got a jacket or something to just throw on them? And what she should have said was no. But because she didn't want to say no, she was like, oh God. And then got very upset that she felt she'd had to cut COVID corners, to quote her. And I was talking to my line producer when they were kind of reporting this back, and I said, but she should have just said no. You know, no is a legitimate answer, but as crew, we're just not used to saying it. And, you know, that's what I was trying to impress upon the crew on Pennyworth, and I'll be saying again to Avenue 5, it's like, no is now a legitimate answer. If the answer's no, you've got to tell us no and not feel.
Yeah, good. If it's no because, if it's no because we can't break the rules and
COVID safety reasons is a legitimate no. So, and it's been really interesting to watch that play out in, you know, the things that we have done badly have always been because somebody didn't feel they could say no. And so actually it's having to re-educate crew on certain things. One thing I will say though, recce's are like a million times better because it's four of us. And there's not 1,000 people hanging around talking about the Rolodies, and you don't have to pitch up and interrupt, and there's 17 conversations going at once. There's one conversation and everyone else is on Zoom.
Yeah.
And because they're on Zoom and they're not allowed to be there, suddenly everybody's very attentive. what have I missed? You know, what have I missed?
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to be there. Surely I'm important enough to be there. I don't make the top four or whatever it is. And it's so that, I mean, that was blissful. I was like, great, we should keep this going forwards. God. But
that's an interesting thing though. Are there loads of things, you alluded to this earlier, are there loads of things that you hope will stay, like ways of practice or maybe, I don't know, technology or something?
I mean, I think, in many ways, no, I hope we do revert to the kind of friendly, happy place that we are, because I genuinely believe, particularly when the hours are so long, we do such long jobs in horrible conditions, having a crew that can comfort each other and chat and, you know, shake each other's hands and have a hug when necessary. I think all that is a part of who we are as humans. And so I'm gutted that we can't have that. And I think it creates a more distanced set emotionally, which I don't think is helpful, really. However, that, you know, I'm not going to lie, the quiet that's created for rehearsal is just joyous.
Yeah.
And actually,
yeah,
getting used to the fact that they can't just come through anymore is, you know, it will all go out the window the minute we're allowed to. But, you know, it is interesting to see how few people you can get away with. And I hope crew remember that, that actually it's like, you didn't need to bring in the whole truck, did you? No, you haven't used it. Leave it.
Yeah. But yeah, but then, you know, to stick up for people who have trucks, you guys, you know, you throw things at us that we don't expect. Okay. So we have to be ready to answer anything. Yeah.
No,
do you know what I mean?
I genuinely don't mean the prop.
Yeah.
I normally mean
of
the
course.
Three grip trucks that have.
Yeah.
Why $25? Why? I've got two cameras.
Why yeah.
$25? Somebody answer that, please. We just do.
Well,
it's
yeah.
not an answer in my book.
But no.
You know, particularly when you can't move around the stage for gear. Oh, Jesus. You can't have it if it's in the fire lane. Out. You know.
What would you say was the show or film that you've worked on that you enjoyed the most? Maybe not necessarily the best end product or film that you love, but maybe the experience about shooting it.
That's actually quite easy, which I'm surprised by. I did a show for the National Theatre called My Country. With
okay.
director was Rufus Norris, who is the artistic director of the National. DP was Andrew Dunn, who is just, you know, the most experienced, most beautiful human being. And it was one of those things that really shouldn't have been fun, because I think we shot, I think my final call sheet, Andrew framed our final call sheet because it had 70 pages on it. Because it
Whoa.
Was it was a play. It was a play that the cast were performing whilst we were shooting it. So they had two scripts. They had the one that they were filming that was ever
yeah.
so slightly different from the one that they played every night twice a week on Wednesdays. And, you know, I had to let the cast go at 12:30 on Wednesday and fill the day, the whole cast, everybody,
yeah.
and fill the day with supporting artist action. Or and I had no third. I did the smoke. It was, but we just had the most wonderful time. It was, we were,
yeah.
We had to follow the cast around. So I think we were in Coventry for a bit and then Birmingham because they were on tour. So we had to go where the cast
yeah.
was. And it
oh, okay.
really shouldn't have been fun at all, but it just was. It was fabulous. We all had such a lovely time. And it was about Brexit. So what the National Theatre had done is they'd gone round post-referendum and taken and interviewed lots of different people all over the country. And then the cast, they'd put together a piece which used verbatim what they'd said. So very, very similar to
yeah.
London Road. I don't know if you saw that for the National, where this lady.
No,
so the London Road was about the Ipswich serial rapist or serial killer, and he lived on London Road. And when he was caught,
okay.
The journalists interviewed all the neighbours, and this woman did this amazing musical where she used verbatim the interviews of those that lived on the road. And the National Theatre
oh,
put
wow.
that on, and then they turned it into a film. And this was similar. So we had Brexit verbatim from all over the country.
Okay.
And it was just wonderful. It was a beautiful idea, and it was great fun. Great fun. It shouldn't have been.
That does
was,
sound good.
It was great.
Yeah. I mean, the subject matter of either of those is
yeah,
depressing.
Yeah, but it was
but,
really...
But yeah.
It felt like doing theatre. It was a company feeling, where theatre is a lot more forgiving and what's the word? They allow other people's opinions, whereas film doesn't. You know, film is only interested.
More collaborative, perhaps.
Precisely. And there is a camaraderie that comes from that, which you don't see on film sets.
Yeah.
So it was just really lovely to be with a bunch of, so half of us were theatre folk and half of us were film folk. And so
that's nice.
It's quite a nice blend, if you see what I mean, of the two worlds.
Yeah, you get to see how they do their job and they get to see how you do yours
yeah.
and you find like a happy
happy medium
place in the middle.
Yeah, so that was probably my best job ever, I think.
Okay.
But I'm very lucky, I've got lots I could have picked. Loads.
Yeah, no, exactly. So saying that you've done so much and in so many different forms, what is there any, or if anything, is there anything you that you would like to do that you haven't done? Maybe maybe not a type of job, or maybe like specific directors or crew that you'd like to work with.
I think you're always looking for the thing you haven't done enough of. So, for example, I don't think I've done enough underwater.
Okay.
I've done a bit, but I haven't done very much. So I was up for a film which was like 6 weeks in the tank at Pinewood, and I was really quite excited about that. I couldn't do it in the end. It clashed, but you know, it didn't matter that the film wasn't the best in the world, or that at the time it had Harvey Weinstein at the top, which, you know, industry wise we've always sort of known. But I was like, I need more underwater on my CV. I haven't done enough of this process. I'd like to know more. So there's kind of things like that that I'd like to do. I tend to find leave your directors on the wall. So I did a block of Trust, which was ran by Danny Boyle. You know, but I was 18 when Trainspotting came out. You know, that film does not belong to him anymore, as far as I'm concerned. It belongs to me and my mates and my generation. So I'm not starstruck very often, but I found it quite weird to be around him, and I found myself pulling away because I didn't want to know about him as a man. So I was like, no,
I see.
You're actually too important to where okay. you belong in my life for that.
Yeah.
I don't want to know that you get grumpy if your tea's cold, or, you know, or, and I'm not saying that he does, but I did find that I was just like, actually, I don't want to get to know you. I don't think I want to first view you because you're too up there. Do you know what I mean?
But yeah, I do. So it's that sort of meeting your heroes thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And
because they're never going to live up to what you've created in your mind of the legend and the mythos of that thing.
And I don't think I'm like that with many actors anyway, but I had a beautiful moment on Avenue 5 where Blackadder and Fawlty Towers are kind of the things I grew up on. And of course, Hugh Laurie is George. And so I did really well. I did really well. I was so proud of myself. But at one point he turned around to me and he said, we were talking about something. And he said, well, and he corrected something that I'd said, and I went, no, that's much better, well done. And he said, yeah, well, you know, not to blow my own trumpet. And I just went, oh, you could at least have told me you had a trumpet. And he just looked at me like I was an idiot, but I kind of love you anyway, you horrible idiot.
Yeah.
And I was like, come on, you literally just said that to me.
Do you find that like actors remember their things that they've said and done and like catchphrases or anything like that? I've heard stories of people saying things to actors and then they're going,
what are you talking
about? I don't know what you're talking about, because I've done 100 films and that was one day in 1972. How am I supposed to remember that?
I think it depends on the actor. Like, for example, I think Dennis Hopper, for example, you know, can't remember much of the 70s, thanks. So there's no point trying to talk to him about that. And I think also certain actors, I think Hugh's different because Hugh's just done so much that you could you could pick House or his jazz career, or you could Bit of Fly and Laurie or Jeeves and Worcester. I mean, the man's done so much wonderful so many wonderful things that actually he doesn't want to talk about it, but he will, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas certain actors that are kind of pigeonholed on one show, an actor I can't mention, but, you know, there is a certain very popular show that you just cannot talk to him about because in his mind, he's done so much other stuff since, but nobody remembers that. They always go back to that one thing. Yeah. So he just won't talk about it anymore because he'd spend his whole life just talking about that.
I think that was the way with a lot of the Star Wars crew, the actors on the original Star Wars films. I think Mark Hamill suffered with that for a long time before the reboots and stuff. He just wouldn't be interviewed about Star Wars because he had so many mixed feelings. I don't know his exact feelings, but because Harrison Ford became the, you know,
the one,
and but it was his film, and, you know,
and
he did a lot of animation voiceover and stuff rather than acting and stuff. It's interesting to think about how actors, because I don't really talk about actors a lot on this, but to how actors actually think and about their career, because for us it's culture. Do you know what I mean? Like you were saying about Danny Boyle, that's part of your culture and your upbringing. Yeah. For him, it was a job.
Exactly.
And now for you, things that you do are your job. Yes. Will be the next generation's culture. Yeah, yeah. And I mean,
I did League of Gentlemen. So, I mean, that,
yeah.
In that kind of cult thing. Yeah.
Is there any advice that you would give to anyone starting out in TV in general or looking to get into the AD department?
Persistence. In one word, persistence. So I think it's very difficult for anyone on the outside to believe this is true, but I will go from not needing anybody at all for the foreseeable future to suddenly needing somebody for tomorrow in 10 minutes. You know what I mean? And at that point, you're sort of going, oh, God, who knows? And, you know, we always ask each other who we know that we like. And because...
Yeah.
It's such a fast moving thing. Invariably, you're going back to the first person you can find in your recent history that was good. And, oh, try them. They were good. They did, you know. And so therefore, when I say persistence, what I mean is what I tell people who I've asked to email me regularly is that
yeah.
they want that firstly, just because you don't get a reply, don't believe that means you've been rejected. It doesn't. It just means we're busy. And that you know that actually we've gone, oh, okay, great, or not, you know, doesn't always follow that way. But the people I believe are good and I want to work with again, I'm kind of saying to them, listen, you won't hear from me for ages, but what would be helpful is, you know, you send me an email every 6 to 8 weeks, you put in the heading how I know you, you know, you need to remind me who you are. I mean,
that's a good point.
Of crew. I don't remember everybody's name or you know, a runner that I've seen one day 5 months ago. I'm not necessarily
going to remember the name. You may remember them because of the way they looked or
the job,
what the job was or, not necessarily their name because you might not even learn people's names sometimes. I know crew that I've worked with two or three times and I'll go, what is your name?
I can't remember.
Because we've never actually got to that point where we've said, oh, my name is this and my name is this. Because you've been so busy, but you get on really well.
Yeah.
And then you realise, I don't know your name.
Exactly. Or, you know, just the sheer number of people that come through, you're just like, if I've seen you for one day, don't get offended that I don't remember your name because I'm always talking to my third. So I'm going to talk to Josh all day and he's going to disseminate what I need doing. That doesn't mean I don't think you're really good. It just means that I'm busy. So I said, that, you know, put in the title how we know each other and, you know, what you've done for me specifically, if you have worked with me before. And then just every 6 to 8 weeks, just send me a kind of a light kind of, hi, how you doing? Just letting you know what I'm up to. Here's my CV when you're crewing. Type thing, because that works, because if you don't do that, what happens is your CV ends up 4 months down my page and I'm not going to go that far. If I need somebody in a hurry, I'm going to go, oh God, who did that recently? Oh yeah, great. Call them first, you know, and then, so persistence is a key thing. I would also say, remember, we all know each other. So, you know, how you perform on that one day is important. You know, we notice stuff. And the other thing that I find with baby ADs is that they have no sense of urgency because they haven't realized that every moment that I spend, the whole set spends waiting for you to do something is X number of dollars or pounds out of somebody's pocket. The shooting, I mean, I dread to think that it is on Avenue 5, but I mean, it's at least 20 grand an hour. So when you break that down to minutes, if I'm waiting for you for 5 minutes, you see what I mean? So, you know, that kind of appreciation that the set is not a group of people working together. It's individuals working together to create something. So if I'm waiting for something, everyone else has to stop.
Yeah.
So it's really important when you're asked to do something, you do it quickly. The best, you know, or if you can't do it immediately, you're saying why you can't do things immediately. And the other one I find is that baby ADs don't always appreciate that ADs are meant to be observant. So I do notice when you're talking. I do notice when you're on your phone and not paying attention. I do notice when I can tell that I've been talking in your ear and you haven't heard a word I'm saying because you're whatever it is. We do notice
stuff.
It doesn't go, we really do notice what is going on. So you know, because that's part, it's literally part of our job. So don't assume you've got away with stuff. I dislike it when ADs, baby ADs, try and pull the wool over my eyes. And I'm like, do you think I'm stupid? And I think the other thing to say is that when I was a runner, I thought everybody was as keen as I was and worked as hard as I did and wanted it as much as I did. And that's not true. The amount of people that are coming in that just go, oh, yeah, well, you know, how much you can pay me? Oh, my God. And, you know, well, I can't do Thursday. Oh, can't you? Okay. Mm. Well, bye.
Yeah.
You know, the most of us who have got in have sacrificed our lives at the beginning to get in.
Yeah.
You have to do the same if you're serious about it as a career. And if you're not, go and do something else. That's fine. You know?
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Like, I agree with you there, because I remember when I started out, I just said to myself, like, just clear my slate, like, just keep it open. I'm available. Yeah. And that sometimes that means, and often that means, you can't go to the thing. You can't go to that wedding. That night out is going to have to be cancelled. Yeah. And the holidays are penciled, not booked.
Exactly. I mean, for me, I don't miss weddings and I don't miss funerals. And those are the only two things that I say I don't miss these things, and I don't expect my team to either. But it's an attitude. It's all about attitude at the beginning as well. That aptitude and training can be taught, where attitude just can't. And you're looking for somebody who's keen and attentive, but calm and thoughtful. Do you know what I mean? So, which is a really difficult balance. But like, for example,
it is. Yeah. But it's also a balance that you can get better at. It's not necessarily, as a runner, day one, it's not necessarily something you have to have fully formed. No. You just have to know that that's where you're going.
Yes, exactly. So, for example, I had a really eloquent email from a young lad who's just finished some course. And I thought, okay, I'm about to hire at the moment, so I'll give him a go. And so when I wrote to him and said, look, I'm crewing up in the next couple of weeks, you know, are you interested in being interviewed for this? And his answer back was, oh, yeah, that's great. But, you know, I don't have a car at the moment. Should I hire a car? So I was like, I'm your potential boss. I don't want to be answering questions about your private life, about whether or not you should hire a car. That's, you're meant to be a problem. You're meant to be showing me that you're a problem solver. The very fact that you're asking me for advice on this is a worry. And then he wrote to me, I didn't respond to that one. And then he wrote to me again on a Sunday and then kind of said, oh, you know, I'm just really keen and, you know, really, I want to do anything to kind of do it. So, you know, I'm going to stay in a hotel near Leavesden. Are there any hotels in Leavesden? And I was like, okay. I'm not Googling or your mum. So I won't be interviewing him now. And I will write to him soon and tell him why I'm not going to interview him. But do you see what I mean? Yeah. That panic of
course.
You are only concerned about yourself. You're not thinking about what I need from you. What I need from you is a calmness that I can give you instruction and trust you to do it. If you were asking me
where a
hotel is nearest a very major studios, you're not showing any aptitude that you can look after yourself, and therefore you're not attractive to me as a team member.
That's it. It's about, I suppose it's about being asked to do, like, if someone, now I have that often with a job. If so, someone comes to me and says, oh, are you available from Tuesday for the next 6 weeks? I don't say to them, yeah, I am, but I've got to sort out accommodation and I've got to get someone to babysit for my kid, blah, blah, blah. I mean, if I can't do it, I'll tell them they're the reasons why I can't do it. But like, I won't bore them with my life or involve them in decisions, because they have 100 other, their own life and own things to worry about. And that applies, because, you know, once you hire that person who asks you 10 questions when you ask them one, you know that when you tell them on set, oh, I need you to go and get this actor to do this, and you know that you're going
to
have...
Well, how do I do that? Why do you need them now? And not interested in do what I tell you to do, please.
Exactly. Yeah. You need to be able to tell someone to do something, and then they protect you from all their worries and all their concerns about that thing, and just go and do it and figure it out on their own.
Precisely. And or... You know, if you genuinely don't know how to do that, then you're asking your peers.
Yes,
you're
exactly.
You're not asking me.
You
know? Yeah. So, I mean, obviously there's a level of which I will obviously take questions on training and stuff when it's appropriate. But I think that's part of the understanding of knowing when it's appropriate. And that's about picking up That's about being emotionally intelligent and astute enough to understand, no, she's busy now. Not now. I'll ask her later when we finished and we're in the truck and we're just having a kind of catch up about the day. I'll go, oh, you know, what do you mean when you said that? What does that mean? And then,
yeah, because that's important. Exactly. That's important to ask questions like, because, and this comes up a lot on the show as well, is the jargon on set is, is massive, and especially in AD, because it's all military talk over the radio and there's all codes and, asking at the moment is not the cool, is not the cool thing to do. But like, maybe like, okay, go, okay, ask someone else who isn't literally talking to a director about the money they're going to spend on the show. Do you know what I mean? So find out from the community. Cause, and also as well, a piece of advice to people is that if you ask other crew members, they're really likely to help you.
Absolutely.
Like, no one is against you succeeding or knowing anything. Like, I have it a lot, because being a standby prop, like, we have sort of probably a disproportionate amount of downtime on a set, because we'll be there at the morning, we'll set everything up, we'll be there ready to, you know, so when the scene is happening, we don't really have much to do, because our props are on the set with the actors, you know. So I spend a lot of my time talking to new ADs and new runners and new crew in general, and third ADs is pretty much who I spend my entire life with on the film sets, you know. So I learn a lot, and I really enjoy talking to people and giving them advice, and if they say, what does this mean, what does that mean, because it's also, it's like they've taken it out of their sphere, so it's like if they're embarrassed that they don't know something, they haven't told someone who is in their job that they don't know it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, oh, it's that comfort in strangers kind of thing of like, a prop guy, he's not going to tell them that I don't know that. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's a good piece of advice. Ask other crew, also, because we've been doing it for a long time as well, and we all absorb lots of information just by osmosis of being next to the thing. I know a lot about grip department, never worked as a grip. I know a lot about lighting, never worked as lighting, but you just hear it and you absorb it. And I imagine you do as well. Like, I imagine you've never done any of these jobs, but you know them because you're just around them.
I have bashed, I camera assisted for about a day and a half, hated it. And I have boomed a few times, not strong enough, awful.
Booming is a very specialized job. I was talking to a sound recordist on this show a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that's the one job where production think is easy, and they think they in lower budget they think they can chuck it on a runner, but it's so nuanced and it's so expensive when it's wrong.
Absolutely A friend of mine was she's a sound recordist now, but she she was like Ridley Scott and Tim Burton's boom up. You know, Ridley Scott does six cameras and you don't know what half of them are. She was like
ninja style. Having to,
it's like it's a dark art. Both sound and light for me are dark arts. And you're like, I don't get. I'm not going to pretend to get why one DP can go, yeah, I'm lit, and then the other takes 10 hours to get every flag off the lighting truck.
That's the thing, those kind of departments, you realize that there are 100 ways to do this, and the people that I like to work with are the people that can go, yeah, we don't need all that equipment. Like, that is one way of doing it, having all the equipment out. But there's another way of doing it where you, I imagine you love this, is when they go, yeah, no, we don't need that. Just give me this and I'll flip that, change that, done.
Mm-mm. To be honest, it's about, because I work with a DP who I love dearly, and he lights by eye. But he's a pain in the bum, because I'll say, how long do you need? He'll be like, 20 minutes. So I'll send the actors to their trailers. And then literally go, I'm lit, really. Oh, you bastard. I've literally told them they've got 20 fucking minutes. So just go and change something, okay? I'm not bringing them back straight away. Because
now I look silly.
Yeah, it's like, we both look daft. It's like, so just... accurate is what I'm after. You can tell me it's going to be 2 hours, you can tell the producer it's going to be 2 hours, but I'd like you to be accurate in your assessment.
No, you're right. Like, there's that thing, that thing about like people getting stuff done quicker than they thought, and also like not messing the actors around and sending them back and forward, because, and also like on a runner as well, like that's a tough job, or a third, or to take an actor somewhere and then hear in your ear, no, we need them now. And then you're like,
exactly.
Jesus, I've got to tell them that they don't have 20 minutes to go and call their mum about their dog.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And then
I've been there.
I'm quite hot on I can always tell new runners that work for me, because they think they can get away with AD schmutz. and like, oh, we're just coming. Yeah. I was like, what does that mean? Where are you? And
traveling.
Like, oh yeah, I can't. I never use the word traveling anymore. John Hurt said to me on Alan Clark, I'm not fucking cattle, Lydia. So I've never used it ever again. So traveling is banned on my set. But it, nice. But it just, you know, it's just like, we're nearly there. I don't know what that means. Tell me, what does that mean? I'll be 2 minutes. Yeah. But I'm literally counting because I am trying to instill, and I'm not doing it to be a total cow. What I'm trying to instill in them is I require accurate information. If you're going to be 5 minutes because the actor's in the toilet, tell me that. It is far better to tell me the truth than have everybody ready and then we're all just standing there. It's like I can tell everyone to relax and they can put that down and they can sit down for a couple
of minutes. Someone could do something that they needed to do. Yes. Exactly. So, like, if say the DP needed to send his focus puller to go and do something, he's been on the focus all day and he's not gone to the toilet. Yeah. So, if you're saying there is 5 minutes, he can go to the toilet and he'll be a better focus puller for the next 2 hours.
Exactly. So that's exactly what I mean. So I'm genuinely trying to instill accuracy over. Yeah. I don't want to get shouted at, so I'm telling you we're coming when we're not. That's far.
Well, that's it. Like. It does come down to them protecting themselves rather than protecting the job, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But it's the phrase of like a slightly annoying truth rather than a beautiful lie.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. And I think the other one is that, you know, the other one I pull up new runners on very quickly is it's like, listen, you, because as you've alluded to, the level of jargon is enormous. There is a great difference between a dropped scene and a cut scene. For example, and if you're new, you don't know that that's a massive difference. So I've always said to my team when they start, when you were handing over a message, you were literally to say what I say,
the same verbatim.
Yeah. You don't change a word of that sentence because the minute you change it changes its meaning. And if I'm wrong, you allow me to be wrong, and that's fine. I take that bollocking. But if you have changed something I've said, it's on you.
Yeah.
So don't do it.
Because you're, so say you say to someone, this scene has been cut, or no, this scene has been dropped, and then they say cut. Yes. So then the second thinks that scene doesn't need to be rescheduled, and therefore that actor doesn't need to be called in for that day. And then that car doesn't need to be booked to that house. Mm. And then that catering doesn't need to be paid for. Yep. So, and also what happens is that chain of events can happen and you don't know about it because you've said dropped.
Yeah, exactly.
They've heard cut.
Yeah.
So you're doing your job, and then by the time you finish at the end of the day, your second comes to you and says, oh, this is so because we dropped that scene, cut that scene, blah, blah, and you're like, hold on, what? This has all happened without me knowing. Yeah,
exactly. That kind of miscommunication is rife on film sets. And it's to do with the fact that we change our mind every 10 minutes and we work very long hours and most of us spend our lives permanently tired. But, you know, you had to be wary of that and hold, you know, just hold systems to avoid it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think a lot of time people say do nothing, get ahead, which is a popular phrase in film. I think what they basically mean by that is don't do anything you can't undo.
Yes, yeah. And I think there is a great wisdom in just hold on, just wait.
I've
found that very difficult over the years because you're kind of naturally proactive and you want to get going on stuff, but actually it is a very wise phrase.
For art department we get sort of someone turned to us and go, yeah, no, we don't need that now actually.
Like,
and no, then I'm just yeah. So that's the thing, like, because I've been doing it for a while now, and if I have a junior with me or something, you know, someone who's dressing or we're doing two units and I've got a dresser with me helping out, they'll go, oh, shall I just quit? I'll run that back. And then I'm like, just hold on for a minute, because I can see in my eye, I can see the director's now talking about that thing with the DP and they're looking at me.
Yeah.
So I know that does need to still be here. So let's just cool off. Yeah, that's the thing. Not doing things as soon as they're said, because
just hold.
It might come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it normally does. And again, I come back to the conversation we had earlier about someone's talked a director out or something, and generally they will return to what they said. Do you know what I mean?
Because I suppose at the end of the day, like, we all have our jobs to do and they're all very important, but we're here making TV, we're making a visual thing that it's the director's vision that we are all trying to get to. So the script is there, the director is there, they're trying to turn the script into a TV show that we see. So at the end of the day, it does end up being what they want and what they need to get it to us. So that's kind of the most important thing. As much as we all like to feel that our thing is the most important thing, every department thinks that their thing is the most important thing.
To be there, but right away.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. It's the grouping of all those people that always have to be there first. And in finding a nice sort, I suppose your job is kind of finding the least difficult order of everything and the most efficient order of everything to deliver the highest quality thing you can get.
It is. I get eminently frustrated when I've worked with a DP recently who makes his sparks work through rehearsal. And I'm constantly saying to him, just tell him to stop. He's like, well, you shout at me because I'm not ready. It's like, no. But the point is, you have to stop now. This is the actor's time for them to work, and you are disturbing them. Why don't you understand that? It's not all about you. And I think as I alluded to it before, when it's great, it's great. But when it's crap, it's terrible. And when you get the kind of slight misplacing of personalities that don't quite see eye to eye, that's not huge amounts of fun.
No.
It's just
especially when it's TV and it's 6 months.
Oh, no, I mean, I'm quite lucky. I've kind of, for some reason, first do blocks. So
yeah, that's true.
Go in and out a bit. So we
four episodes and you're off.
Yeah, normally two at a time. So, you know, we have a much easier time, I think, than crew. I don't know how you do those 6-9 month gigs.
Awful. I tend not to.
No, don't blame me. No, that's far too difficult. But
it is. I think and I feel that we are at a good place here to end our conversation. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about what it is to be a first AD. I really enjoyed it. Like I feel like I had an idea of what it was like, but you've kind of shown me the whole picture, really, as it were. Exactly. Well, thank you so. No worries. Thank you so much. And I mean, we've never actually been on a set together, so hopefully, maybe.
I don't think so.
No, hopefully, maybe one day that will happen. Okay. Well, have a good day, and I'll speak to you soon.
No, it's been great. Thank you, Jack. Thank you for having me.
Cheers. Okay, me again. So that was me talking to Lydia Curry about her career as a first AD. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did too. I thought she spoke really well about all things first AD, the good things, the bad things, the difference between film and TV. She's worked with some of the greatest crew in TV, so it was really interesting to talk to her about all those massive shows. So all that leaves me to say is thank you to Lydia, and thank you all for listening. And if you think we're worth a 5-star review, just head over to iTunes and, you know, give us a little rating and maybe a review. Okay, so next week we'll be back with another episode, and I will speak to you then. Have a good week, and I'll see you later. Cheers.